Support for the Capital Connection comes from
United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, uupinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm David Gustina. Delighted this week to be joined by Dan Clark, the author of the Capital Confidential newsletter. He covers New York State government and policy for the Times Union. That's the Albany Times Union, the TU, as we like to call it around here. And I'll tell you, I use that Capital Confidential all the time. Welcome to the Capital Connection, Dan Clark.
Happy to be back. DC from the TU.
Yes, yes. DC from the TU with DG on the CC. One of the things that I think is perhaps one of the biggest journalism phrases of all time is follow the money.
Yeah.
Right? Watergate. Where are the politicians getting their money from? And look at this, Dan Clark. Look what I see right here in your CapCon Confidential Here column. I sorted through the campaign filings for accounts controlled by Democrats in the state legislature. I have a list of top entities that gave to the Democrats in the Senate and Senate Assembly. And now you're going to tell our listeners all about that. And I'm guessing part of this is where most of the money comes from, which is healthcare.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly it. Healthcare groups love to give to the state legislature. They love to give to whoever's really in power in the state legislature.
Right.
Right now, that's Democrats, and probably for the foreseeable future, that's Democrats in both the state Senate and the Assembly. So you have groups like the Greater New York Hospital Association, big labor unions, 1199 SEIU, which represents a lot of healthcare workers. They've always been big supporters of Democrats in the state legislature. They want them to stay there and keep doing what they're doing, especially in the past few years with Governor Hochul. They have secured, they meaning lawmakers and the governor, have secured higher Medicaid rates for healthcare institutions. That's huge because New York State has historically, at least over the past decade, only reimbursed these healthcare providers about 70% of what they say is the cost to provide these services. So every little bump that they can give benefits those healthcare institutions. And then the thought is, at least from the union perspective, that money then trickles down to their workers in the form of higher pay and benefits.
And what kind of money are we talking here, Dan?
Well, we're talking millions of dollars. It depends on the lawmakers and how the money's distributed. Of course, a lot of these specialty trade organizations and influential groups will donate to these campaign accounts that are held by each political party in the legislature instead of to one single legislature, or legislator, I should say. Although you will see them donate to individual lawmakers, it's more popular to go into those campaign accounts, and then the, for example, the Democratic Assembly Campaign Committee will choose how they want to distribute that money. These healthcare groups may not know, for example, some polling that's done behind the scenes that shows certain members in areas of the state that are more competitive than other members. So they leave it up to the lawmakers. As long as they know that the conference is supported by those healthcare institutions, that's what matters.
Now, Dan, I know you know this, but I want to ask the question, are we naive or are we savvy? I'm talking about the people who get cynical about this stuff. They say, we know that when you put millions of dollars in the campaign coffers of legislators, there's more likely the idea that you're going to get what you want. And yet these claims to the contrary, I'm responding to my constituents and what my constituents want. The money, I hate raising money, you'll hear politicians say. It's not part of the job I like. I don't like that. I want to serve the people. Which is it?
I think it's a chicken and the egg situation when it comes to campaign contributions. I think that when you look at a entity giving to lawmakers, you could look at it as they're trying to influence lawmakers to do something in the future. There's a specific issue on the table that they're trying to suggestively say to a lawmaker, I will pad your campaign coffers if you vote this way on a certain issue or advocate this certain way. Now, there's the other side of the coin that is, I would say, less nefarious, where maybe a group is saying, hey, you voted for this last year. We really liked that. Thank you so much for doing that. We're going to give you money because we want you to stay in your seat and not be defeated by somebody who may then vote against our interests. So I think that if you asked a lot of these groups which of those two camps they fall into, they're saying, thank you so much for doing that. But I think realistically, the cynic in me says that a lot of them are trying to say, in the future, please side with us.
Yeah, I think that's right. And at the very least, I think if you look at the goo-goo groups, the groups that don't have the money and the power, they have to use the public airwaves and campaigns to get their message out. But it doesn't mean also a group like Compassion and Choices, which worked for 10 years to try to get the medical aid in dying law passed, won't have success. So you're pointing out that, yes, there's a cynical part of this, but there's also good public policy, public support for that good public policy, and a legislator and legislators that will respond when they put their finger up to the wind and say, hey, the people are going this way.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you have to go down the trail a little bit to determine how you're going to feel about these kind of campaign contributions. Do you support a hospital taking money out of its coffers to fill a trade group's coffers that will then try to influence policy at the state level? That's for you as a voter, for a patient to decide if you want to support something like that. Of course, you don't have a choice in the matter. You're paying the healthcare institution and they're using your money how they see fit. But those are the kind of conversations that I think a lot of people have around ethics and campaigns. We have a lot of ethical loopholes in New York State. Just one, for example, lobbyists have to report to the state, for example, what bills that they lobby on behalf of their clients. They do not have to report what position their clients have on something. So if I represent Coca-Cola and I'm lobbying on this big bill on, I don't know, packaging or sugar content in food or something like that, I'm going to assume as a consumer probably that company is against that. But that company does not have to say that. And could you imagine the surprise if they supported it?
Is this accidentally on purpose?
That's one of those things. It's been pointed out by good government groups along several different years. And lawmakers have not so far gotten anything into law that would change that.
It seems to me that because of so many of these ethical loopholes, the lawmakers are in danger of hoisting themselves on their own petard. So they put these vagaries in the language to create a deniability.
That's exactly it, right? If I was a lawmaker and I got thousands of dollars from my party's campaign account, but my party took thousands of dollars from Coca-Cola, right now, there's no way for the public to know definitively what legislation Coca-Cola opposes or supports. If we change that, maybe we could draw a more direct line between how Coca-Cola, for example, is trying to influence a specific lawmaker through those campaign contributions.
We're speaking with Dan Clark of the well-known Capital Confidential at the Times Union, timesunion.com, to find out more. Now, Dan, we mentioned healthcare and the lobbying and the unions and the big business that has all this money to lobby. And yet when it comes to healthcare, I think there's a position of, well, why should it be for profit at all? Why don't we have universal healthcare, for example, not only in New York, but in the country? And that brings me to the left wing of the party, the progressives and the democratic socialists who have been making headway, especially here in New York with Mamdani, mayor of New York City, and his push, for example, for child care that brought the governor on board with him, Hochul, not a progressive or a democratic socialist any level. And of course, that very moniker being compared to communism by none other than President Donald Trump in his quest to have influence over the midterms and perhaps more going forward. So we do have the Democratic Party in New York perhaps moving left, but I see that you spoke to the chair, Jay Jacobs, who said, oh, no, we're not moving further to the left.
His argument and the governor's argument is there are these candidates that have won in these districts, and they're not surprised to see these candidates who are further to the left win in these districts. There's a lot of districts in Queens, Brooklyn, and Manhattan. We would expect a Democrat to win there. What we have not expected historically is for far left Democrats to win there. These are some seats that were held by moderate incumbents. They are other seats that were held by moderate incumbents who are leaving the legislature. So for these progressive candidates to win, they're really building their ranks. The Democratic Socialists doubled. They will double the number of members they have in the state legislature next year, from 7, I believe, to at least 14. And this isn't just Queens and Brooklyn. There's one DSA candidate in Syracuse who won. There's another DSA candidate in Buffalo who won. So this isn't something that is going away. And I think you saw in 2018, the first Democratic Socialist elected to the state legislature, that was Julia Salazar down in Brooklyn. And at the time, that was a big deal. And then 2 years later, we saw a whole group of them elected, including Zohran Mamdani. And since then, their influence has only grown in the state legislature. Just in the past couple of years, some of those members who were elected in 2020 have really started to find their bearing, being really closely involved and influential in legislation involving state prisons and immigrant protections. So it's certainly a party that's shifting. I think maybe in Jay Jacobs' neck of the woods, since he is also chair of a county party on Long Island,
yes.
Maybe he doesn't want to say that part out loud. But when you look at it from a statewide perspective, there's no denying that this party is moving to the left. Whether that's good for them or not on a statewide level, I think, remains to be seen. I think a lot of voters are hungry for a kind of populism that part of the Democratic Party really reflects that the moderates don't always hit.
I spoke with Governor Hochul this week about some of this, and she indicated that the party is strong. We're trying to work together. I don't think you'll see a divide as you might see with the National Democratic Party. But there's, to me, a sign that there's a reckoning coming, that if you look at what's happening with the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, they're in debt. They're in somewhat disarray. The Times did a recent report on that. And since Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, you've had a sharp divide in which direction folks who identify themselves as Democrats think the party should go.
Yes.
And if anything, the progressives are arguing our values will give those folks who have the least more, and that includes many of the disaffected Republicans in the country who turn toward Trump.
It comes down to a capitalistic perspective versus a more socialist perspective. It's not accidental that these are two groups that are against each other. The Democratic Socialists have really hinged on this message telling voters, why are you struggling to pay all of your bills while your neighbor down the street who makes five times as much as you? There are no additional obligations for that person making that much more money. The socialists in the party have done a really impactful job, I think, pitting those everyday voters, of which there are many more, than those high income voters. The problem is that the establishment of the Democratic Party, their view is that these high income voters are often the people who own businesses in New York. They're often the people who run major corporations in New York. They don't want to see those people take their income, their individual income, because these people make millions and millions of dollars that pad the state's coffers in income revenue.
Oh, yeah.
They don't want to take their tax income and the income of maybe workers at their company and bring it to another state. Of course, the socialists will say, we don't think that they're going to move. The Democratic establishment says, we do think they're going to move. The problem is that neither side can tell the future. So
that's right. And if the past is any look into what could occur, it always seems that Americans ratchet back to we're a capitalist society. We can't mess with that capitalism because otherwise that's not America. And I think that's the problem with the progressive side trying to convince the nation that, wait a minute, if we want to have a society that's healthy, that's educated, that has clean air to breathe and water to drink, then those that have the most need to provide enough so that we can all rise together.
The messaging from the socialist side isn't always attractive to the everyday person.
Yep. My taxes are going to go up.
That's a big part of it. They don't do a lot of messaging around the socialism that already exists in society. And I think if they did that more, they might find themselves to be more politically popular. We have Medicare. We have Medicaid. We have Social Security. Obviously, it's right in the name.
We have the post office.
We have the public,
we have public schools.
System. Yes, exactly. Now, the problem with the socialist wing is that then they get into more extreme positions, as the Democratic establishment will say. And I think the average voter would say that they're extreme, too. Some socialists believe that we should not have as much private property as we do have. And in a country that is founded on freedom and where libertarianism is still incredibly popular, even right here in New York State, it's not an attractive position to tell somebody that.
Despite
the
fact that our history is we took property, quote, property from the Native Americans.
Exactly. So it's those kind of conflicts of government can benefit people, but how far do we let government take that is really turning off all of these voters that could side with the DSA, but maybe right now don't see themselves as part of that wing and want to give up anything.
Yeah, we're definitely in an era where the argument is there's too much government. Less government is more. Well, we're certainly not going to have it solved in our lifetime. I don't think, Dan Clark. But let's move on to this story that you have here in your Capital Confidential. This is in bills passed but pending. HOCA will soon have to decide if people who work or volunteer with children in certain contexts have to be screened against sex offender registries. That's currently not required in many instances. Huh?
Yeah, that's true. There are these extracurricular programs that you may enroll a child in. Think of sporting leagues. This isn't your after-school school sports team. This is an extracurricular third-party sport or recreational center, something like that. They are not required by law to screen their employees for sex offenses. So this bill, what it would do is just enact that requirement. And it would say if somebody's moving from out of state, for example, that the state would or the entity would have to screen where they lived as well. So it extends protections that are already in place for the vast majority of places where children might find themselves.
Now I want to talk about the robots are coming. The robots are coming.
Yeah.
The AI move. There's a whole set of things I want to get into here with you. But let's first talk with the actual humanoid robot that was supposed to be in Salamanca.
Salamanca, right? City School District in Cattaraugus County.
Yeah. And that was quickly jumped on by the education department, which said, hey, I don't think we want humanoid robots in the classroom right now.
The interesting thing, though, is, David, that the school district and the company announced this in late June, and we are in late July now. So the state education department did not do anything about this as it was announced.
Maybe they're not reading the Times Union.
Here's the thing. It wasn't the Times Union. New York Focus published a story about this robot in mid-July, I believe it was.
And I talked with them on the air about that story when they released it.
Yes. And a few days later, that's when the state teachers union came out and said, hey, we really don't like this, and pointed out that this is a company that also has a history of a separate arm of itself making sex dolls as well. So that's not a great connection to make when we're talking about children in schools, obviously. It is a fascinating story of who is really watching our schools district by district. And the state education department, there are hundreds of districts. They have so much going on in that agency. I would have been honestly surprised if they had known about this if a journalist hadn't reported on it. It's one of those things that makes you really take a step back and say, I didn't even know that this was on the table for a school district to bring in a robot like this. And mind you, this isn't like Terminator. This robot wouldn't have been walking the hall.
I don't think it has legs, right?
Right, exactly. It would have just been stationed in a classroom and a chat bot that isn't connected to the internet. So it would have only been able to talk about things that the school said it was allowed to talk about. That being said, there were concerns from the education department and from the teachers union over data privacy, because the robot would have been able to remember students by a number. They would have said, I'm student number 123, not I'm Bethany from Smithtown. So how does it store that information? And the other concern is, how much are we replacing education in the classroom? Is this going to be a slippery slope for teachers or teachers' aides to be replaced by this kind of technology? Those are the questions that surrounded it before the plug was pulled by the district.
In a larger sense, AI is powered by data centers.
Yes.
And those data centers are popping up all over the nation. Governor Kathy Hochul recently announced a one-year moratorium on hyperscale data centers. Those are 50 megawatts, right? And the legislature also has bills for 20-megawatt data centers. We don't know yet if the governor's going to sign that bill, but many are saying you're hurting business. They're going to go to other states. They won't build here. Look how fast it's going. And she's suggesting that these municipalities are reaching out and saying, we need some rules in place here. We don't have the resources to handle all this. Can the state help? And she's saying, yes, we're going to establish some rules. We've already reached out not only to the AI companies themselves to let them know there are going to be some rules coming, but we've started the ball rolling with things like something called the Grid Reinforcement Fund. I may have that a little bit wrong, but the idea of we want these companies that come in not to raise the utility costs for our New York customers, but rather pay for that as part of what they do. So these municipalities, if they so choose, can approve data centers in the future. It's gotten her pushback.
It has gotten her pushback, but I think sometimes the loudest voices are not the most voices, if that makes sense.
It does.
This issue has turned out to be, on a national level, a bipartisan issue. I think that there are business groups who have said, because these are their members, it's not like you would expect them to go against their own members. So business groups have said the governor and the government should not be doing anything to inhibit business in New York when there isn't a direct threat necessarily, and we don't have a lot of these open-ended questions answered, especially around the energy piece of it. But I think that's also the governor's point, is that there are so many unanswered questions about where the energy is going to come from to power these data centers, if it's going to drive up people's rates. And there are, as you mentioned, moving pieces on this that are aside from the governor's executive order. The Public Service Commission, the state Public Service Commission, which regulates utilities, currently has a proceeding open that would create a new utility class for these data centers to force them to actually pay more. So that's one piece of it. As you said, the bill that the legislature passed is very much still on the table. We don't know exactly where it's going to land, whether the governor is going to sign it or not. But I think it is an interesting look at how we were talking about before between the capitalists and the socialists.
Yeah.
Is how far can you go to support business until it becomes a problem that needs to be addressed statewide? And this is one of those areas where the governor saw a clear opportunity. And I think polling had shown, even though she said she doesn't rely on polls, but polling had shown bipartisan support for some sort of restriction or regulation around these data centers, because you have in a lot of these rural areas where these data centers were looking to set up shop, these are areas that may not necessarily have supported the governor in her election.
Including Long Island.
Exactly. And maybe now that she's done something like that, some of these independent voters will be convinced to go out to the polls and vote for her or show up to the polls for the first time in years.
What's interesting is that part of this whole data center problem is environment, the use of water, how much water it uses and the problems that can result because of that. And yet she pushed back on the climate goals not so long ago.
Right.
So you've got this sort of situation where she already pushed back the climate goals. You've got this she's doing because of the climate. How does that square? So I asked her about that, and she pointed out that a large part of this is the federal government as well. We've just seen them acknowledge, New York Times again, that they stopped environmental energy grants for blue states, states they perceived as liberal and not going for Trump. So that kind of a partisan move, and funds that were already allocated being pulled away. So she may have a point there.
It's a game of political chess for the governor.
Yeah.
on this particular issue. She can say New York does not have enough energy to power these data centers, and she can turn around and then say New York doesn't have enough energy to power these data centers because the federal government has shut down our wind projects that are supposed to power, I believe, 1.5 gigs once they are online, if they ever do come online off the shore of Long Island and
right.
New York City. So it's a political opportunity for her to say, I am doing everything right, they're doing everything wrong. Whereas at the same time, the Trump administration is really trying to convince the state to allow more gas to come into New York through the Constitution pipeline up through Pennsylvania. That's something that both the company and the Trump administration say would lower energy prices in New York. So,
and the governor hasn't pushed back on that.
She has not pushed back on the creation of the pipeline. She's pushed back on how the company is now trying to do it. They're trying to circumvent the state's review process.
Oh, yeah.
So that's another game of political chess where she can say at the end of the day, maybe if it is approved, I oppose the way that they did it, but it is going to help with affordability.
And the political chess of housing. We're going to reduce some of the environmental restraints on building housing so that they can be built faster. So you're right. It's a constant game of political chess where the governor is involved. But yet so much of this AI data center push, as I think you've pointed out, you're not going to stop it.
No, it's here. You can't unring this bell, certainly. Yeah. There is so much in our society that has now so quickly been integrated with AI that I think it would be a very difficult thing to take it away. Now, I don't know enough about the infrastructure of AI and how its brain works and all of that. So I can't tell you how data centers, where they need to be, what they need to do, what the different ones do. But what I can tell you is that people in these communities where they are being built, all they see, if they don't see a direct economic benefit, is a giant building, and they don't like that. And I don't know if I would either if it was built in my backyard. That being said, do I want to give up my ChatGPT, my Codex? I don't know. That's the balance that we have to make in this society.
Ugh, It's an unbalanced balance.
Yeah.
Dan Clark, we're running out of time quickly here. I wanted to move towards a bill that I believe the major sponsor is Pat Fahey, Democrat from the Capital Region. And it has to do with us in the media and AI and labeling what we do as being generated, if it is, by artificial intelligence. And many of my colleagues say, no government is going to tell us in the media what to do. And yet, I think in this disinformation age, we do need to have properly labeled content.
The thing with AI and media is that it's already in it. And it's definitely not going away. And in a lot of ways, the future of journalism in this country will hinge on which journalists decide how to best and responsibly use these tools and who decide to use them for nefarious purposes. That's the divide in media now in terms of technology and in terms of editorialization. But for example, in my daily use of AI now, I'll use it to take a large document, let's say a 170-page court decision, and I'll say, hey, read through this court decision, summarize what it means, tell me the impacts, all of that. But then I will then take that information and verify it within the document itself. I don't just trust the AI. Now, what Pat Fahey's trying to do is say, be transparent with your readers, with your listeners, in how you use AI. And also, what she's saying is that protects the journalists because they're saying, well, you put this safeguard on it so that if AI makes a mistake or if something happens that you didn't intend, that disclaimer is there. A lot of media companies, and I'll just use mine as an example, Hearst, who I work for, has been incredibly responsible with integrating AI into its work by offering us and requiring us to undergo constant trainings on how to use this technology responsibly and accurately.
That's excellent.
So I just want listeners to know that we are doing this, but it's not a bad thing. It's going to help everybody so much.
Yeah, including taking out the ums and the uhs of this conversation, if I so choose. Dan Clark with Capital Confidential, timesunion.com to read more. He's always on the scene. He knows what's going on. And that's why we reach out to him from time to time. Dan, I can't thank you enough for joining us on the Capital Connection this week.
Happy to be here anytime.
Support for the Capital Connection comes from
United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.